listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Monday, October 26th. I'm Taylor Fisher from Drake University. Here's our first story. Junt hopes to help people through position at Thrivent. Written by Tim Johnson. Former Habitat for Humanity of Council Bluffs Executive Director Glenn A. Junt has found a new way to help people. Junt is an associate representative for Thrivent, a nonprofit fraternal benefit society. Although it originally served only to Lutherans, Thrivent now welcomes Christians seeking to live out their faith, spouses of Christians who seek to live out their faith, or youths being raised in the Christian faith, according to its website. "I really love that you get to help people," she said. "Not everything I do is about money. It's about relationships." Junt also likes Thrivent. "Thrivent's a really great organization," she said. "They do community events in communities they serve, and they're partners with nonprofits, and the members of Thrivent get to do volunteer action teams." The organization sponsors service projects that benefit nonprofit organizations, Junt said. Last year, Thrivent employees worked more than 17 million volunteer hours. It was through Thrivent's efforts to serve Council Bluffs that Junt connected with the organization. "I first worked with Thrivent at Habitat," she said. "They came alongside us and did faith builds. After I left Habitat, they asked me to consider working with them." Junt went through an extensive training process, all online except for testing, and became licensed in securities and health and life insurance. On October 1st, she opened an office in the Park Building at 500 Willow Avenue, Suite 414 in Council Bluffs. Thrivent helped her set it up. "All my furniture came from Thrivent, so they helped me furnish the office," she said. Junt said she was excited to be able to have her office in Council Bluffs. "I'm licensed in Iowa and Nebraska, but I really wanted to serve our community," she said. As a Thrivent representative, Junt helps clients with financial advice, investments, insurance, banking, and gives back to their communities. "Thrivent uses a holistic approach to helping people," she said. "We talk about financial health to live with," she said. Junt sees a need for organizations like Thrivent. "People need a strong financial foundation," she said. "I really want to holistically help people in our community, and I know there's a need out there for that," she said. "Nobody teaches you how to invest your money or what to do with your money," she said. "We find out what your goals are and concerns. We do advice and planning with no fee." The representative helps the client make short-term and long-term goals, she said. What we really want to do is help people achieve financial clarity," she said. "We believe money is a tool, not a goal." Junt enjoys the social aspect of the position. "I really like the personal aspect of it," she said. "I get to meet and talk to a lot of great people, and that's really great." Junt can be reached at 402-718-3684. No Good Fellows Campaign in 2020, written by Courtney Brummer Clark and Emily Sheeby. For the first time in 70 years, there will be no Goodfellows Holiday Assistance Program in Council Bluffs. The local Goodfellows Board of Directors voted unanimously this month to dissolve the organization in 2021, citing fewer community partners as the largest factor in the decision. Since 1949, Goodfellows' four basic goals were to provide food and toys for Council Bluffs area families during the holiday season, seek applications for assistance from families in need throughout the community, produce paper gift certificates that area businesses would accept as payment in lieu of cash. Businesses would then submit certificates for full payment from Council Bluffs Goodfellows. Raise funds locally to fund the annual program by sharing stories of need in the community via a partnership with the Daily Nonpareil. Goodfellows Board of Directors President Tom Smith said due to advanced technology, very few businesses are able to accept Goodfellows paper certificates. Along those lines, Goodfellows was not able to purchase gift cards in volume. In addition, the organization lost its promotion partner, the Daily Nonpareil, due to the newspaper's dramatically reduced staff size. Smith, who has served as the president of the board for the past 19 years, has also been the publisher of the Daily Nonpareil for the past 20 years. As such, he not only directed the Goodfellows board activities, but also led the Nonpareil's efforts in publicizing the application process for the annual campaign, as well as coordinating the fund drive portion of the campaign. "It was a well-oiled machine when I arrived in early 2001," Smith said. "I think there were nearly a dozen staff members heavily involved in the process. There was one or more staff members from every department involved." Members of the Daily Nonpareil's advertising department promoted the application process, the news team wrote and published 40 or so stories about the program each year. Folks in the accounting department kept track of all incoming and outgoing funds, and staff members from every department help stuff and mail hundreds of envelopes addressed to program recipients, Smith said. And it happened year after year for 70 years. However, because of the changing times and the shrinking size of the Nonpareil staff, Smith said it simply wasn't possible for the Nonpareil to fulfill all those roles any longer. During Goodfellow's heyday, Smith said, the Nonpareil had a staff of 60 to 70. Today, he said, the Nonpareil staff numbers are less than 20. In making the official announcement of the closing down of Goodfellow's, Smith expressed his gratitude to all those who helped the organization throughout the years. There were so many key players, Smith said. There were the volunteers who served on the board of directors. There were the businesses that were able and willing to accept the Goodfellow's paper certificates. And there was the decades of support provided by the Iowa West Foundation. Each was a key component in completing each year's successful campaign. In a recent memo to the Goodfellow's board of directors, Smith said four key factors related to the success the organization enjoyed. One, through its 70-year history, the Council of Goodfellows successfully assisted thousands of area families by giving each an opportunity to celebrate the holidays. Without Goodfellows, those celebrations and the joy and peace they brought would not have happened. Two, Council Bluffs Goodfellows was the catalyst that allowed thousands of families to share their blessings with those who were in need of assistance. Despite all the work the board of directors did, without the generosity of so many in the community, Goodfellows would never have succeeded. Three, for several decades, the Iowa West Foundation offered a matching donation program that provided Goodfellows with the ability to provide a higher level of support to families in need. For years, the Iowa West Foundation matched, on a dollar-for-dollar basis, every dollar donated by someone or some entity in the community. The matching program doubled the amount of funds raised each year. Four, the business community willingly participated in the campaign by agreeing to accept the Goodfellow's paper certificates. And because the Daily Nonpareil committed so many of its resources to do the behind-scenes work. In his memo to the board, Smith also addressed the number of nonprofit organizations, churches, etc. in the community that now seek to assist those in need during the holidays. Assistance that was not available in 1949 when Council Bluffs Goodfellows began. Locally, there are other organizations offering holiday assistance this year. Those organizations include the Salvation Army. Those in need of holiday assistance this year can register online at bit.ly/35HHD U for the Salvation Army Christmas Assistance Program. Registration is open to Pottawatomie County residents only, and an individual registration is required for each child. After completing the application, you will receive a confirmation email and then another email at a later date to confirm a pickup time for the gifts. Due to COVID-19, gifts will be prepackaged. For questions, call 712-328-2088. Open Door Mission. For Thanksgiving, the Turkey and Fixins program at the Open Door Mission will begin on November 3rd and run through November 25th. The Open Door Mission says, this program is designed to empower low-income individuals and families in need with the holiday food items, a turkey or ham, stuffing, mashed potatoes, and gravy, so families are able to cook a Thanksgiving meal in their own home rather than eating at the Open Door Mission for Thanksgiving. Only one registration per address. Stop by Council Bluffs Family Outreach /Donation Center, 1612 Avenue D from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., Tuesday through Saturday to register and receive holiday food items starting on November 3rd. For Christmas, the Project Santa's Drive-Thru Christmas program will help low-income parents provide their children with gifts under the tree on Christmas. This will be a drive-thru program with pickup on a Saturday in December that has yet to be announced. The drive-thru program is designed to serve children 12 years old or younger and will provide 1 to 2 toys for each child, books, diapers, coloring books, and a holiday food box. Materials needed to register a child are a birth certificate or document verifying age and the child's social security number. The parent registering must also have their photo ID and a current piece of mail. Registration is from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Tuesday through Thursday in the months of November and December at the Council Bluffs Family Outreach /Donation Center. The list of local available assistance will continue to update and can be found at nonpareilonline.com. If your organization or one that you know is offering holiday assistance, contact Emily Shebe at emmalee.scheibe at nonpareilonline.com or 712-325-5742. Holtz, Branstad, Lobosack, Stump in Iowa ahead of election, written by Tom Barton. From abortion to the pandemic to energy policy, surrogates for President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden threw jabs at the other side during stops in Davenport Friday as both campaigns worked to turn out voters and energize supporters in the final stretch before the November 3rd election. Famed former Notre Dame football coach Lou Holtz and Terry Branstad, former Iowa governor and former U.S. ambassador to China, stopped at the Scott County Republicans' headquarters on North Brady Street. The pair were joined by Branstad's eldest son, Eric, a senior advisor for the Trump 2020 re-election campaign, and Republican State Senator Marinette Miller-Meeks of Ottumwa. Miller-Meeks is running against former Democratic State Senator Rita Hart for the open Iowa 2nd Congressional District U.S. House seat, being vacated by Democrat Dave Lobosack. Lobosack stopped at LeClaire Park in downtown Davenport early Friday afternoon to campaign on behalf of Biden and his running mate, California U.S. Senator Kamala Harris, and Democrats were up and down the ballot. He was joined by Iowa Representative Phyllis Thede, Democrat of Bettendorf, and Kay Pence, Iowa Vice President of the Alliance for Retired Americans. Holtz, 83, who Trump last month announced he intends to award the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian honor, told a small group gathered for the Catholics for Trump MAGA meetup that, "I don't see how there's any possible other choice you can make other than President Trump if you are Catholic." Holtz proceeded to argue that Catholicism is under attack, pointing to Harris's 2018 questioning of a judicial nominee's membership in the Knights of Columbus and about stances the Catholic group has held on abortion and same-sex marriage, beliefs shared by many conservative Catholics. Vice President Mike Pence, during their last debate, called out Harris for attacking the group just because the Knights of Columbus holds pro-life views. Harris responded, "Joe Biden and I are both people of faith, and it's insulting to suggest that we would knock anyone for their faith, and in fact, Joe, if elected, will be only the second practicing Catholic as President of the United States." Holtz, too, criticized Biden for his stance on abortion and suggested the Democratic presidential nominee would roll back conscience protections for Catholic nuns and other religious employers who object to providing contraceptives. Notre Dame distanced itself from Holtz after he questioned Biden's Catholic faith during the Republican National Convention. They and other politicians are Catholic in name only and abandon innocent lives, Holtz said at the Republican National Convention. President Trump protects those lives. On Friday, a defiant Holtz vowed, "I will not be intimidated. I will not be silenced. I'm going to speak what I feel. And I was taught that if you abort a baby, that is murder." Biden, a Roman Catholic who has wrestled publicly with abortion policies for decades, this summer declared that he no longer supports a longstanding congressional ban on using federal health care money to pay for abortions. The former vice president's reversal came following criticism from rivals and women's rights groups, who argued that the Hyde Amendment is another abortion barrier that disproportionately affects poor women and women of color, the Associated Press reported. Biden's platform promises to expand access to contraception and protect the constitutional right to an abortion. Biden supports repealing the Hyde Amendment because health care is a right that should not be deemed on one zip code or income, according to his campaign. And the public option will cover contraception and a woman's constitutional right to choose. Lobosack, meanwhile, criticized President Trump for fumbling the nation's response to the worsening COVID-19 pandemic, with the U.S. topping 1,100 COVID deaths per day. "Joe Biden understands what the average Iowan is going through," Lobosack said. "He understands the economic problems that are facing Iowa and facing this country. He knows that the pandemic is out of control because of the irresponsibility of this president and not taking it seriously enough. We can't solve the economic problems of this country until we solve the problems related to the pandemic. We can say we're going to open up, but if we open up irresponsibly, then we're just going to have more problems." Terry Branstad blamed Beijing for the coronavirus pandemic, accusing China of covering up the pandemic. The COVID virus is a problem in Europe. It is a problem in Asia. It is a problem in India. It's a problem all over the world, Branstad said. So we have been the victim of the communist Chinese system, and now the world is having to deal with it. I am proud of the fact that President has put together Operation Warp Speed, and it looks like we're getting close to having a number, being able to have medicine that will be able to provide protection for people that would be exposed. On energy, Lobosek called out Trump for his comments on Thursday's debate attacking wind energy. Trump claimed wind turbines kill all the birds, is extremely expensive, and is more harmful than natural gas. Wind power is a big deal in Iowa, Lobosek said, noting more than 40% of the state's electricity comes from wind generation. And Joe Biden is a supporter of renewable energy in all of its different manifestations, but the president was talking about wind. He doesn't get wind power. He has no idea what he's talking about. He has no idea that we've got 9,000 to 10,000 jobs in Iowa in the wind industry. Those would be destroyed if he remained president of the United States. He doesn't understand what this does for the state of Iowa in terms of the cost of energy. Iowa mourns. From blankets to backpacks to key fobs, woman wore her love for the Iowa Hawkeyes. Written by Michael Niehaus for the Burlington Hawkeye. Shauna Gelliland always ended nightly chats with her mother with the same few phrases. Good night, sweet dreams, don't let the bedbugs bite, love you and talk to you tomorrow. Although Shauna lived in a Burlington Group home a few hours from her family in Lake Ozark, Missouri, she kept them close through frequent phone calls, ensuring their bonds weren't severed by the distance, said her mother, Martha Gilliland. She loved hearing stories about her nieces and nephews and talked fondly about the family's camping trips. She called me at least half a dozen times a day, Martha said. Shauna, who had been living in the eastern Iowa River town for about a year, died of COVID-19 on April 25th, less than a month before her 45th birthday. Born at Illinois' Chanute Air Force Base, a mysterious antibody-resistant infection left Shauna with a burning fever at 6 months old. Unabating, the prolonged fever caused brain damage that resulted in a learning disability. Doctors told Martha her daughter's life had been irrevocably changed. She'd never be able to live independently, they said, or get behind the wheel of a car. But I worked and worked and worked with her very hard for several years, and she said she was able to do both, Martha said. Shauna lived in her own apartment off and on for several years while holding down a job as a cashier. When her living situation allowed, she'd take in a cat to cuddle with as she watched movies or listened to country music. At 18, she got her driver's license. She had difficulty understanding the written test, but when asked the questions aloud, she passed with flying colors. She drove much like she lived, carefully and with determination. Despite her disability, Shauna enjoyed crossword puzzles and books, especially romance novels. She didn't want a romance for herself, but she loved reading romance, her mom said with a laugh. Shauna was known to wear her love for the Iowa Hawkeyes whenever she could, and jumped at the chance to attend any home football or basketball games. She wanted everything Iowa Hawkeye, from blankets to backpacks to key fobs, jackets, clothing, Martha said. It was all Iowa Hawkeyes. But her love for Iowa sports was eclipsed only by her generosity. Quick with a smile and a hug, she'd buy little trinkets for family and friends on trips to Walmart, excited to see their reaction when gifted them. She was one of those who would give her shirt off her back to anyone who needed it, Martha said. She ended up giving away a Hawkeye jacket to a friend who really wanted it. Shauna made at least one good friend at each of the group homes she lived in, her mother said, and could recall their names and a few tidbits about them years after she moved out. By the time she was in her 40s, she could remember every address number, every phone number we had from the time she was little, Martha said, and we lived in over a dozen places. When her mother finally allowed her to have a smartphone last year, Shauna reached out to her old friends on social media. She loved Facebook, her mom said, and even tracked down babysitters who'd watched her as a child. As the pandemic raged across America, Shauna added a frame to her profile picture that said, "Stay home, save lives," and posted reminders to wear masks. Now Martha leans on some of the small gifts Shauna gave her over the years for comfort. The little teddy bear holding a heart embezzled with, "I love you," the decorative sign hanging in her parents' camper that declares family lives here. Each is a reminder of Shauna's quick smiles, warm hugs, and the special way she ended every phone call. Good night. Sweet dreams. Don't let the bedbugs bite. Love you and talk to you tomorrow. Face of the day. For more than 30 years of marriage, Sherry and Dennis Gunderson have had each other's backs, except when it comes to football. Sherry is a native of Lincoln, Nebraska, and Dennis grew up in Underwood. Sherry is a graduate of Lincoln Northeast High School, and Dennis graduated from Underwood High School. They both attended the University of Lincoln for their undergraduate student studies, and later earned master's degrees from the University of Nebraska at Omaha. They both have backgrounds in insurance and met in 1986 while working down in Lincoln. They've been together ever since and have been married for 32 years. Sherry is currently the tax director for the Logier Corporation, and Dennis is a chief underwriter at Reinsurance Group of America. Some say better late than never, a phrase the Gundersons had in mind yesterday afternoon as they watched the Big Ten Conference kick off week one of college football. As a Lincoln native, Sherry bleeds Husker red. Dennis, a Southwest Iowa guy, hails the Hawkeyes. Although he is an alumnus of Nebraska, Dennis said he doesn't have any special feelings for the football program. "I have to live with it," he said with a laugh. The Gundersons have lived in Oakland for almost 25 years. Every week or so, the two enjoy cruising into Council Bluffs to enjoy food and drink. To celebrate the opening week of Big Ten football, the two have stopped at Barley's to sip a couple beers as Nebraska took on Ohio State, and later the Iowa-Purdue matchup. The two love craft beer and often take advantage of the expansive tap list at Barley's. Whether their teams win or lose, Sherry and Dennis Gunderson remain strong together, although having bragging rights never hurts. Pheasant Hunters gearing up for highly anticipated season opener. Written by the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Tens of thousands of hunters in blaze orange will take to the fields when Iowa's pheasant season opens October 31st. And with pheasant populations on par with the best counts in the past decade, including six of the nine survey regions averaging more than 20 pheasants per route, the most seen since 2007, hunters can afford to be optimistic. "Given how things are lining up for the opener, the weather is the only thing that could throw a wrench in it," said Todd Bogenschultz, upland wildlife biologist with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. "Success during last year's opener was impacted by a delayed harvest, where about 90% of the corn and 40% of the soybeans were still in the field. This year is the exact opposite, with an estimated 65% of the corn and 90% of the soybeans have already been picked. The advanced harvest and uptick in bird numbers is creating interest from pheasant hunters beyond the state's border." Bogenschultz, along with other Iowa DNR wildlife staff, have been getting a number of calls from non-resident hunters interested in hunting Iowa after the good news from the August pheasant survey. "It definitely has people asking about our counts, investigating where the better areas are," he said. Iowa's annual August roadside survey found a statewide average of 20 birds per 30-mile route, an increase over 2019's 17 birds per route. Hunting will be at least as good as last year, when 52,000 pheasant hunters harvested an estimated 284,000 roosters. "If hunter numbers continue their upward trend, we could see the harvest be closer to 2008's, when we had about 86,000 pheasant hunters harvest 400,000 roosters," he said. "In 2008, we had 17 birds per route, so we're 3 birds higher average this year. If we could put the hunters in the field, we could see a bump in the harvest. The population is there to support that." One piece of advice, he said, is that hunters in West Central, Central, and parts of Southwest Iowa impacted by the drought should scout the CRP fields they plan to hunt, because the habitat could be gone. An emergency declaration from the U.S. Department of Agriculture opened CRP fields in the drought-stricken area to hang 100% of fields. Iowa pheasant season. Iowa pheasant season is October 31st to January 10th, 2021. Shooting hours are 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. The daily bag limit is 3 rooster pheasants with a possession limit of 12. Hunters must have a valid hunting license and habitat fee. Hunters are required to wear at least one article of external clothing with at least 50% of its surface area, solid blaze orange, hat, cap, vest, coat, jacket, sweatshirt, shirt, or coveralls. The same blaze orange hunting rules applies while hunting quail, gray partridge, and ruffed grouse. August roadside survey. Iowa has conducted, in one form or another, an annual pheasant survey since 1930s that was standardized in 1962 to the version conducted today. The survey is used to track pheasant populations and correlate it to other data sets on habitat, land use, and weather. This is how we know how weather impacts pheasants and how land use has changed, and that change has impacted pheasant populations, Bogenschultz said. The data collected helps with our hunting regulation framework. It's how we know that closing pheasant season doesn't impact the population. Hunters want the data on how this year compares to last year and where the better bird counts are, he said. The August roadside survey covers more than 6,500 miles of routes driven on gravel roads at dawn on mornings with heavy dew. Hen pheasants will move their broods to the edge of the gravel road to dry off before they begin feeding, which makes them easier to count. The statewide survey takes place between August 1st and 15th. The August roadside survey has been conducted over the same route since 1962. In addition to pheasants and quail, the survey collects data on partridge, cottontail, and jackrabbits. Iowa's youth enjoy special pheasant season October 24th to 25th. Iowa's young hunters will get to experience the first cackle and flush of the year during the youth-only pheasant season October 24th to 25th. The residents-only youth season gives Iowans age 15 and younger the opportunity to hunt for rooster pheasants without purchasing a license, habitat fee, or taking hunter education. Youth must hunt under direct supervision of an adult 18 or older that has a valid hunting license and habitat fee. Special youth-only season allows young hunters an opportunity for success without pressure or competition from other hunters. Only the youth are allowed to shoot pheasants, and they may bag one rooster per day. Online Hunting Atlas offers places to go. Iowa hunters have been using the interactive Iowa Hunting Atlas to find new places to go hunting. The Hunting Atlas features more than 680,000 acres of public hunting land that is owned by the state, county, or federal governments. It is available to view online at iowadnr.gov/hunting. This tool allows hunters to see which zone the public area is in, type of shot allowed, This tool allows hunters to see which zone the public area is in, type of shot allowed, wildlife likely to be found, get an overhead look at the terrain, and a downloadable or printable map. The mobile version of the Atlas will show hunter location on the area if granted permission. The Atlas view from above allows hunters to zoom in on an area, see how to get there, and the lay of the land, and where one parcel of public hunting land is in relation to others, and print off maps. Information is updated as public hunting lands are acquired. The Hunting Atlas also includes private lands enrolled in the Iowa Habitat and Access Program, where private landowners receive assistance to improve habitat on their land in exchange for opening the property for hunter access. Sitemaps are available online at iowadnr.gov/IHAP, showing boundaries, which species would be most likely attracted to the habitat, and the location of a comment box where hunters are encouraged to leave their feedback on the program. Walk-in public hunting through IHAP is available between September 1st and May 31st. You are listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Monday, October 26th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. My name is Taylor Fisher from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. Fact versus falsity versus opinion. Let's review. As overwrought as many Americans are over the upcoming election, it has been months since this column has elicited a death threat. Even so, I got edgy the other night when an unusual loud pickup, all tricked out for a demolition derby, pulled up in front of our house. I was on my way to fetch Albert the cat. Always his own man, Albert relocated to a neighbor's front porch after we adopted a young dog he dislikes. I collect him every evening and carry him purring back home for supper. It's understood that the dog will remain in the backyard. He eats, visits for a time, and then returns to Albert World Headquarters, a nightly ritual. False alarm. The trucker with the throbbing muffler had business with the neighbors, or possibly their daughter, and pulled away before I returned. Even so, it got me thinking. Have I gone soft? Specifically, has this column become less upsetting to the kinds of knuckleheads who think kidnapping and murdering the governor of Michigan an exciting idea? Or has my policy of blocking emails from guys who make threats left me defenseless in a fool's paradise? People never talk that way to me in person, and cops will tell you that guys who send threats almost never act. 4 years ago, I got several threats from Russians who thought Trump should defecate in my mouth, as one charmingly put it. They claimed to have They claimed to have operatives watching me, but made dumb mistakes like ones I'd make if I tried to pretend I was in Moscow. You know, at the risk of getting ahead of myself, mistakes like pretending that a guy that evidently didn't know lives in Los Angeles dropped off a laptop filled with incriminating secrets at a computer repair shop in Wilmington, Delaware, 3,000 miles away. That was a dumb mistake. So sorry, Rudy. You've been had. But then Rudy Gillilani's the kind of hotshot lawyer who recently told the Daily Beast that his Ukrainian source, Andriy Derkach, is a Russian spy is no better than 50-50. You wouldn't want him handling your divorce. Your Honor, it's 50-50 my client's running around. Russian operatives, history shows, tend to be infinitely cunning, but equally clumsy. They can't even seem to poison Putin's enemies lately without A, failing, and B, getting caught. But I digress. If I'm getting fewer threats these days, hardly a day passes without someone accusing me of lying. A lie to these naive souls being any fact or opinion with which they disagree. It's amazing how many people out there, even among the minority that actually read newspapers, don't grasp the most elementary things about how journalism works. Real journalism, that is. To elaborate, this is an opinion column. It tends to be argumentative, yes. However, it's a point of pride and professionalism to base those opinions on facts. After all, what's the point of winning an argument if you have to cheat? I also have professional editors who question any factual assertion they find dubious. It's professional manner with them, too. A good editor can save you from yourself. However, there's also an awful lot of masquerading going on in the wider world, and it's understandable that some readers get confused. Lots of outlets mimic the outward forms of actual journalism without the content, such as Rupert Murdoch's own tabloid, The New York Post, for example, which is why it speaks volumes that even the Post's lead reporter on the Hunter Biden email scandal declined to allow his byline on the story. No surprise, as the Washington Post's Matt Boots points out, the very first line was false. Hunter Biden, the New York Post article reads, introduced his father, then Vice President Joe Biden, to a top executive at a Ukrainian energy firm less than a year before the elder Biden pressured government officials in Ukraine into firing a prosecutor who was investigating the company, according to the emails obtained by the Post. In reality, an undisputed evidence at Boss Trump's impeachment trial and two subsequent Republican-led Senate committees also determined there was no such investigation. That's a fact. It's also one of the biggest reasons why the U.S. government and the European Union were so eager to get rid of corrupt prosecutor Viktor Shokin, precisely because he wouldn't touch anybody politically connected, including Burisma, the Ukrainian gas company upon whose board of directors Hunter Biden inappropriate but not illegally sat. Joe Biden's actions was contrary to his son's interest. Meanwhile, NBC News reported that the FBI is currently investigating whether the emails hyped by the New York Post are linked to a foreign intelligence operation. That's a fact, too. In consequence, my opinion is that the farcical aspects of the entire episode make the odds a lot better than the 50-50 that Russian spies staged. Oh, and Rudy Gillilani shouldn't be doing much investigating in bars. Now we're on to obituaries. Susan Renee Atkinson, February 20th, 1957, and died on October 20th, 2020, preceded in death by her parents, George and Marjorie Yocum, brother Nick Yocum, sister Connie Yocum, survived by sons Jim Watkins and Josh and Maria Watkins, daughter Jody and Anthony Franklin, granddaughter Chelsea and Tim Benton, grandchildren Ben Watkins, Addie Watkins, great-grandchild Charlotte Renee Benton, siblings Lori Cornelison, Jody Kosak, Peggy Martin, Deb Childers, Becky Rablin, and George Yocum. Many nieces, nephews, great-nieces and nephews, and great-great-nieces and nephews. A celebration of life to be held at a later date. Ruth Cody. Ruth Cody, age 96, passed away peacefully at Bethany Lutheran Home on October 22, 2020. She was born on January 24, 1924, to Jens Anderson and Ellen and Lauritsen Anderson. Ruth is survived by her son, Bob and Marcia Cody, daughter Diane and Josh Hersey, brother Harold Anderson, sister-in-law Harriet Anderson, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. She was preceded in death by her parents, infant children, Jimmy and Kathy, sisters Elsie Lemer and Norma Thomas, and brother Richard Anderson. Private family services will be held. Larry McNam. Larry McNam, aged 71, passed away peacefully at the Atlantic Specialty Care on October 18, 2020. He was born on November 5, 1948, to Virgil and Grace Jensen McNabb in Council Bluffs. He was preceded in death by his parents. Larry is survived by his sister Judy Kreiner of Trainer, Iowa, children Christopher and Heather, niece Natalie and Steve Sutton, nephews Fred and Michelle Crone, and Jason and Kelly Crone, and a host of other family and friends. No services will be held at this time. Richard L. Wilson, age 93, of Missouri Valley, Iowa, died on October 22, 2020, at the Longview Nursing Home in Missouri Valley. Richard graduated from Missouri Valley High School in 1948. He proudly served his country in the U.S. Marines, fighting in the Korean War in the Chosin Reservoir Battle. Richard married Shirley Bunch on May 20, 1952, in California. He worked for the UP Railroad. Richard was a member of the Missouri Valley Christian Church. After his retirement, he joined the Gideons. He enjoyed gardening, had a huge garden. Richard is survived by his wife, Shirley Wilson, five children, Dale and Stephanie Wilson of Escondido, California, Rodney and Patra Wilson of Richland, Nebraska, Sharon and Mark Leonard of Ottawa, Iowa, Dennis and Charlene Wilson of Columbus, Nebraska, and Sandy and Gerald Zeiser of Logan, Iowa. 10 grandchildren, 16 great-grandchildren, and many other relatives and friends. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. on October 28th at the Missouri Valley Christian Center, with visitation 1 hour before the service. Joanne Johnson. Joanne Johnson, age 79, passed away October 22nd at Longview Nursing Home in Missouri Valley. Joanne was born February 25, 1941, in Shenandoah, Iowa, to the late Walter and Maisie Trulinger, and worked many years at Mutual of Omaha. Joanne is also preceded in death by her husband Richard in 2012 and son-in-law L. John Hansen. Survivors include her son, Kevin and Sarah Johnson of Pacific Junction, Iowa, daughter Kelly Hansen of Exira, Iowa, grandchildren Matt Johnson, Rachel and Zach Fleming, Raven and Brian Walker, Elizabeth and Aaron Pritchard, Nathan Johnson, Taylor Christensen, 10 great-grandchildren. Visitation Tuesday 7 to 8 p.m. at Maher Funeral Home, 121 South 7th Street. Graveside services Wednesday 2 p.m. at Rose Hill Cemetery in Shenandoah, Iowa. Memorials are suggested to Longview Nursing Home. Ella Lee Smiley, age 91, of Glenwood, Iowa, passed away October 22, 2020, at her home. Ella was born February 1, 1929, in Harrison County, Missouri, to the late Neil and Evola Johnson. She graduated from Gilman City, Missouri High School in 1947. Ella married Robert Smiley on December 15, 1947. They were blessed with four children, Helen, Sarah, Robert, and Nancy. Ella worked at the Glenwood Resource Center for 20 years, retiring in 1991. She was a member of First Baptist Church in Glenwood. In addition to her parents, Ella was preceded in death by her husband, Robert Smiley, on March 8, 2010. Ella is survived by her children, Helen and Dick Dimon, Sarah and Charles Gansky, all of Glenwood, Robert and Jane Ward Smiley of Council Bluffs, Nancy and Rodney Stivers of Glenwood, 14 grandchildren, 23 great-grandchildren, brother Alexander Johnson of Gatlin, Missouri, two nieces, Janet Gibson and Lona Bisonette. Visitation with the family Monday 2 to 3 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Graveside service and burial will follow at 3:15 p.m. in Memorial Park Cemetery. Memorial contributions are suggested to V&A Hospice of Southwest Iowa. Pods for third round quarterfinals released, written by Derek Nilrin. On Saturday, the Iowa High School Athletic Association released third-round pod pairing for the 2020 high school football playoffs. Third-round pods consist of four teams, with the winners of the third round playing the other winner in their pod in the quarterfinals. All third-round matchups are currently scheduled to be played on Friday at 7 p.m., followed by the quarterfinals slated for Friday, November 6th. After the quarterfinals, teams will be repaired. Semifinal games will be played November 12th through 14th, with championships game November 19th through 20th. semifinal and championship games will be at the UNI Dome in Cedar Falls. Listed below are the third round matchups. Class 4A, Pod A, Bettendorf 5-2 at Pleasant Valley 8-0. Dubuque-Hempstead 7-1 at Iowa City West 5-0. Pod B, Ankeny Centennial 2-5 at Southeast Polk 7-0. Cedar Rapids Prairie 5-2 at Cedar Rapids Kennedy 3-3 at Kingston Stadium. Pod C, Cedar Falls at 5-2 at Ankeny 7-1. Indianola 4-4 at Waukee 6-2. Pod D, Waterloo West 4-4 at Dowling Catholic 6-1 at Drake Stadium. West Des Moines Valley 3-4 at Urbandale 6-1. Class 3A, Pod A, Boyden Hole Rock Valley 6-2 at Spencer 6-2. Sergeant Bluff Lutton 6-2 at Webster City 8-0. Pod B, Ballard 8-1 at Lewis Central 7-1. Carlisle 6-3 at Harlan 8-0. Pod C, Grinnell 7-2 at Pella 6-2. Dubuque Waller 6-2 at Cedar Rapids Xavier 8-0. Pod D, West Delaware 9-1 at Washington 8-0. Davenport Assumption 8-0 at North Scott 5-1. Class 2A, Pod A, Esterville Lincoln Central 7-1 at Central Lyon / George Little Rock 8-0. West Lyon 7-1 at Spirit Lake 5-2. Pod B, Atlantic 7-1 at West Marshall 7-1. Greene County 7-2 at PCM Monroe 8-0. Pod C, Tipton 5-3 at Comanche 7-1. West Liberty 5-2 at Williamsburg 8-0. Pod D, Monticello 6-1 at Watkins 6-1. Independence 6-1 at Salone 6-2. Class 1A, Pod A, Western Christian 5-3 at OAB CIG 8-0. Emmitsburg 7-1 at West Sioux 5-2. Pod B, South Central Calhoun 7-1 at South Hamilton 8-0. Denver 6-3 at Southeast Valley 8-0. Pod C, Pella Christian 6-3 at Van Meter 8-0. Underwood 8-1 at Mount Air 7-1. Pod D, Mediopolis 7-2 at Columbus Catholic 7-1. Dyersville Beckham 6-2 at Sigourney Kyoto 8-0. Class A, Pod A, South O'Brien 6-3 at St. Albert 6-2. Riverside 8-1 at Logan Magnolia 7-1. Pod B, Hartley Melvin Sanborn 7-2 at Hancock 8-1. Nottoway Valley 4-5 at Grundy Center 9-0. Pod C, Lisbon 7-2 at Wapsie Valley 8-1. Alburnett 6-2 at Iowa City Regina 7-1. Pod D, MFL Marmac 8-1 at Edgewood Colesburg 8-0. South Winnishek 8-1 at St. Ingsger 8-0. Bell shines as Purdue rallies past Iowa 24-20. West Lafayette, Indiana. Purdue quarterback Aiden O'Connell noticed how special sophomore receiver David Bell was from the time he came on campus. "He's a kid that physically is a mismatch for more players," O'Connell said. "Even more than physically, his mental makeup is extremely impressive. He knows where to be and when to be there. He's a quarterback's dream out there." Bell caught 3 touchdown passes from O'Connell, including the game winner, to guide the Boilermakers to a 24-20 victory over Iowa Saturday in Big Ten season opening action. "David is a special player," said Brian Brome, who was acting head coach with his brother Jeff sidelined after testing positive for COVID-19. "He can play in the slot. He can play outside. He can make contested catches. He's able to do everything from the receiver position. We are just lucky to have him. The quarterbacks love having him." With the Boilermakers' top receiver, Rondold Moore, sidelined for undisclosed reasons, Bell caught 13 passes for 121 yards. His difference maker was a 6-yard touchdown from O'Connell with 2:15 remaining in the fourth quarter to give Purdue the lead. Purdue's defense stiffened on the final drive, stopping Iowa on 4th and 10 from its own 44. "Aiden has been clutch in the fourth quarter drives throughout his career, and he was able to put together another good one," Brome said. O'Connell, who was named starter just before the game, completed 31 of 50 passes for 282 yards. "Aiden's mental makeup is special to walk on at Purdue. When we were signing 2 quarterbacks in the class that he was in," Brome said, He's a resilient guy that has a great mindset about him. Nothing really bothers him. He didn't do everything perfect, but when it came time, he performed. I'm proud of him for getting it done. Xander Horthrath, who got the start at running back because King Doerr was out with a hamstring injury, led the Purdue rushing attack with 129 yards on 21 carries. Iowa was daring us to run the ball, and for us to do it and to do it effectively opened up the passing game for us, and we put it in, Brohm said. Purdue's winning drive was set up by a big turnover. With Iowa leading 20-17 and driving, the Hawkeyes' Mecky Sargent had the ball stripped by Derek Mackey, and Cam Allen recovered at the Purdue 28. The Boilermakers followed with a 12-play, 72-yard drive. Hawkeyes quarterback Spencer Petras completed 22 of 39 passes for 265 yards for Iowa. I thought we moved the ball well, Petras said, but penalties, misplays, and turnovers will kill you. Iowa took a 17-14 lead into halftime when Keith Duncan kicked a 27-yard field goal as time expired in the second quarter. Purdue wasted a nice opening third-quarter drive when O'Connell was intercepted by Barrington Wade at the Iowa 3-yard line on 2nd down and 10 from the Iowa 11. The Hawkeyes pushed the lead to 20-14 with Duncan's 33-yard field goal with less than 2 minutes elapsed in the fourth quarter. Purdue's 14-play drive stalled, and the Boilermakers settled for J.D. Dellinger's 29-yard field goal to trim the deficit to 20-17. Purdue had it tied at 14-all when Bell caught an 11-yard touchdown pass from O'Connell. Bell opened the scoring for Purdue with a 9-yard touchdown catch in the opening quarter. After Petras tied it at 7-all for the Hawkeyes with a 1-yard quarterback sneak from 10:21 left in the second quarter, Iowa went ahead 14-7 when Sargent capped off an 11-play, 73-yard drive with a 1-yard touchdown run. The takeaway: Purdue managed to win the game without coach Jeff Brohm's guidance. Brohm missed the game after testing positive for COVID-19 Sunday and forced to isolate at home. His younger brother Brian, co-offensive coordinator and quarterback's coach, took over as acting head coach for the game. Marty Bigotti, special teams coach and defensive assistant, also had to isolate. I'm proud of our team to get this victory and our coaches to band together in a time of crisis where a lot of adversity was hitting us and guys had to take on new jobs and new roles, Brian Brohm said. The Boilermakers defense came up with big play when needed to shut down the Hawkeyes. Iowa's fourth quarter fumble probably made the difference. Iowa coach Kirk Ferentz said turnovers and penalties and inability to stop the run were big reasons for the loss. Iowa committed 10 penalties for 100 yards compared to 3 for 21 yards for Purdue. Sanders Hubbard lead number 6 Oklahoma past Iowa State 24-21. Written by Clift Brunt for the Associated Press. Spencer Sanders waited a long time for this moment. Oklahoma State's sophomore quarterback passed 235 yards and ran for 71 and a touchdown in his return from injury, and the 6th-ranked Cowboys defeated number 17 Iowa State 24-21 on Saturday. Sanders suffered the right-hand injury last season and missed most of the action in the final 3 games. This season, he injured his right ankle in the season opener against Tulsa and hadn't played since. His return has had its rough spots. He threw 2 interceptions, but he made enough plays, including a 34-yard touchdown pass to Jelani Woods, to get his team through. I was really frustrated with myself for getting hurt, so I'm really happy that I'm back, he said. A little frustrated with myself with the 2 turnovers today, but I'm going to let it go. Sanders said he was careful, but aggressive as a runner. He had 15 carries, taking away some of Iowa State's focus away from star running back Chuba Hubbard. I ran hard, but I never let anybody one-on-one just take me down, Sanders said. I was always laying my body to the side, knowing I was going to get tackled, just going down rather than taking that extra hit. Hubbard ran for 139 yards and a touchdown for Oklahoma State. With the win, the Cowboys joined Kansas State as the only remaining undefeated teams in conference play. The Cyclones 3-2-3-1 vaulted onto the national radar by beating Oklahoma earlier in the month and were seeking their first ever 4-0 start in league play. Iowa State's Breece Hall, who was second nationally in yards rushing per game, ran for a career-high 185 yards. But the Cyclones were a few plays short and made a few too many mistakes. We definitely left some out there, Hall said. We got down to the red zone a couple times and didn't convert and get any points and took some unnecessary penalties and had miscommunication. It was real frustrating. With Oklahoma State leading 14-7 late in the second quarter, Iowa State drove deep into Oklahoma State territory but had to settle for a field goal attempt. Connor Azalee's 33-yard kick bounced off the right upright with 1:22 left in the first half. It was his second missed field goal of the first half, and Oklahoma State took a 7-point lead to the break. Hall broke away for a 66-yard touchdown run in the third quarter, and the Cyclones tied the game at 14. Sanders' 14-yard touchdown run on the next possession gave the Cowboys the lead again, and Alex Hale's 31-yard field goal pushed the lead to 24-14. Brock Purdy threw a 20-yard touchdown pass to Xavier Hutchinson with 49 seconds remaining to trim Oklahoma State's lead to 24-21. Oklahoma State recovered Iowa State's onside kick, and the Cowboys ran out the clock. "We'll tip our hat to Oklahoma State," Iowa State head coach Matt Campbell said. "Hard-fought football game. They made some plays when they had the opportunity to make them. We had opportunities to make plays and just didn't." The takeaway. Iowa State. The Cyclones entered the game wanting to jump from a team that pulls an occasional upset to a league leader that others chase. The passing game struggled, and outside of two long runs by Hall, so did the running game. Oklahoma State. The Cowboys learned that they can lean on their defense against a quality Big 12 opponent. Purdy passed for just 162 yards. The Cowboys were ranked second nationally in scoring defense and number 6 in total defense, and they lived up to it against a top 25 team. No repeat. The last time Purdy played Oklahoma State in Stillwater, he passed for 318 yards and 4 touchdowns and ran 84 yards and another score in the Cyclones' 48-42 win 2 years ago. Jim Knowles was Oklahoma State's defensive coordinator in both games. Gundy said the game plan was better this year. Overall, I thought our plan was way better than it was when Brock Purdy was here as a freshman, Gundy said. I thought Jim Knowles and them rallied up today, had a good plan, and were able to keep us in the game and force some three and outs. Momentum swing. Hall took off for a 70-yard run in the first quarter, but Azalee eventually missed a 48-yard field goal. It took just 3 plays for Oklahoma State to score. Sanders found Woods for the touchdown pass that tied the game at 7. "I thought it was huge," Campbell said. "That was, if you talk about a difference in the game, that's one of those moments where it drastically alters the game." Quotable. Gundy on the defense. "We haven't made plays in past years like the ones we made today. They're gaining some confidence. Confidence is a powerful thing in life, particularly in sports. Every day they're getting a little more confident." Up next. Iowa State visits Kansas on Saturday. Oklahoma State hosts Texas on Saturday. Oklahoma State runs away from Huskers in opener 52-17. Justice Fields and number 5 Ohio State shook off the rust in the first half and then buried Nebraska the rest of the way. Fields completed 20 of 21 passes for 2 touchdowns and ran for another. Master Teague III rushed for a pair of scores, and the Buckeyes rolled over Nebraska 52-17 Saturday in the Big Ten team's pandemic-delayed opener. Fields, a Heisman Trophy finalist last season, completed his first 12 passes and threw for 276 yards. He ran for another 52, including a stunning 17-yard third-quarter touchdown scramble across the left side that saw him spin past a defender and into the end zone. His 42-yard touchdown pass to slot receiver Garrett Wilson on Ohio State's second drive of the game couldn't have been prettier. The only pass he missed on in the second quarter may have been catchable, but Chris Olave couldn't hold on in the end zone. "You guys saw the arm we saw," Nebraska linebacker Colin Miller said. "He's making throws guys on Sundays make." Olave caught 6 passes for 104 yards, and Wilson had 7 for 129. The Ohio State defense took most of the first half to figure out a way to contain quarterback Adrian Martinez, who marched the Huskers down for a touchdown in the opening 2 minutes of the game. Nebraska tied it at 14 in the second quarter, but an Ohio State field goal, a defensive stop, and Teague's second touchdown run gave the Buckeyes a 24-14 lead at the half. Then came Fields' nifty touchdown run and a 55-yard scoop and a score by Buckeyes quarterback Stephen Banks and Ohio State had it under control. "That's one heck of a run right there," Ohio State coach Ryan Day said. "It's the best way you can end a half and start a game, and I thought it flipped the game." The takeaway. Nebraska effective against the Ohio State defense to start the game, the Huskers couldn't keep up. But Martinez showed flashes of his excellent freshman season in 2018, rushing for 88 yards and a touchdown. "The first half, I thought we did a pretty good job," Martinez said. "We came out aggressive, and I think we continue to do that in the second half, but made mistakes that we can't make against a really good team in Ohio State. Once they got going, Fields made good decisions, and Buckeyes receivers were terrific. The defense gave up some chunk plays that kept Nebraska in the game early, but tightened up." And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Monday, October 26th. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. Iris volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast or any Iris program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. I'm Taylor Fisher from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for listening.